today on Against the Grain, highlights from 2019 from a year's worth of commentary and analysis presented on this program. I'm CS. You'll hear excerpts from five interviews that I thought stood out on the topics of revenge-motivated politics, modern civilization according to Gandhi, state ideology and class oppression, and black identity in relation to black lived experience. All that coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It is my custom, as each year draws to a close, to go through the interviews I've done, come up with a list of favorites, and present highlights of those programs. The interviews will present excerpts from This Hour, feature thinkers holding forth on a range of topics. Helena Sheehan discusses her engagement as a radical philosopher with European and Soviet communism. Manu Samnotra talks about Gandhi's perspective on civil disobedience and about his trenchant critiques of Western civilization. Michael Bourvoy points out key features of Marx's thought and describes how the French thinker Pierre Bourdieu differed with Marx on the issue of worker consciousness. Margaret Hunter identifies what she finds problematic in the efforts of some white people to try on forms of blackness, to take on a kind of black identity. We begin with Max Haven, whose forthcoming book examines what revenge looks like and could look like in the context of capitalism and efforts to resist it. Max Haven is a writer, educator, and movement organizer, and he teaches at Lakehead University in Canada. You'll hear Max use the term revanchism, by which he means a desire or effort to retaliate or take revenge upon those perceived to have deprived one of something valuable. Here are portions of that interview. Let's start with a poster produced in the wake of the 1886 Haymarket Massacre in Chicago. What does it exhort workers to do, and how is rebellion or resistance framed?
Yes, this is a famous poster published by Spies, the famous German anarchist, in response to the Haymarket Massacres, where he exhorts fellow workers to rise up and take revenge against the ruling class who have sent their agents, the police and armed gangs, to murder these striking workers. And Spies in this poster likens the kind of revenge the state has taken on these striking workers, these protesters, to the kind of everyday revenge that the system is taking on the families of working people, especially migrant workers in Chicago. But more generally, that poster and many other cultural works from that famous period of labor unrest in the United States and Europe in the 1910s and 1920s, and before, I should say, as well, the rhetoric is to ask workers to recall themselves as the inheritors of a long line of injustices, who are called upon not simply to avenge the crimes and cruelties done to them and their immediate living families, but also the crimes and cruelties done for decades or even centuries. And I think this most poetically is sort of expressed in Walter Benjamin's enigmatic and haunting reflections in his Theses on the Philosophy of History, where, to paraphrase, he says that the problem with German social democracy in the lead up to the Nazi period is that they focus too much on making an appeal to the working classes on the basis of the promise of liberated grandchildren, the idea that through socialism, the future would be redeemed as a place where one's descendants could live in peace and abundance. And he said that's fine, but what he says is severs the sinews of the working class's greatest strength, which is its spirit of vengeance and its spirit of sacrifice. And these spirits are tied to the idea of avenging one's ancestors rather than focusing on one's grandchildren. And Benjamin's argument, I think, is that what social democracy did is it offered this kind of triumphalist vision where if you just simply joined the party and you sort of acceded to their triumphant vision of a future we're all marching towards together, that would be sufficient. But what was really needed was a sense that we need to overcome a large history of oppression and exploitation together. And this triumphant and very positive vision of social change that the Social Democrats offered for very instrumental purposes neglected the deep-seated resentment and anger and antipathy that is at the core of the experience of being oppressed and exploited. And in the absence of dealing with those sentiments in a productive way that generates solidarity and a vision for a future in which the past is redeemed, Benjamin's arguments is I, in my interpretation at least, that this kind of emotional territory was left open to the appropriation by reactionary forces, notably the Nazis, who were able to offer a very different way for working class people to get a kind of revenge against the system, one that was ultimately catastrophic and in fact deepened and worsened their oppression and exploitation.
One thing that you're very interested in and have been for some time is this phenomenon of financialization. So remind us of what financialization of the capitalist economy was, and I'm going to ask you to be kind of brief because there's so much more to talk about, and tell us what it has done to workers that might be, in your opinion, wreaking a kind of vengeance.
Well, financialization in a limited sense of the term simply refers to the increased power and influence of the financial sector of the capitalist economy. Institutions like hedge funds, investment banks, bond rating agencies, and the like that we became familiar with in the 2008 financial crisis. This influence is, of course, economic in the sense that they have incredible power over capitalist firms, but it's also political in the sense that we know that most governments around the world, with the exception of oil exporting countries, typically are extremely indebted and require more debt every year to make ends meet, largely because they've made a choice not to tax the richest members of society and instead borrow that money from often the very same rich people. So there's an incredible economic and political effect of this phenomenon we call financialization, but I and others have argued that there's also a deep sociological and cultural effect. Sociologically speaking, as the financial sector grows and as public spending diminishes, we begin to see almost every institution of society transformed into a kind of financialized asset. So the example that I often point to is the university, where once upon a time, we imagined that a university was to produce research in the public interest and educate a new generation of citizens to take their place. Now we understand the university to be a site where individuals, young individuals, will go tens of thousands of dollars into debt to purchase a credential that they can then try and sell in terms of their labor power on an extremely hostile labor market. So education becomes this kind of individualized investment rather than a social responsibility. On a much deeper level, though, financialization has transformed each and every one of us into this kind of miniature investor where we're instructed and exhorted to see everything of value in our life, from our education to our relationships to our house to our community, as assets that can be levered towards our own personal competitive gain. This has had a massively catastrophic social impact on individuals and communities as people reconfigure their imaginations to see their society as a hostile and competitive environment. And that, I think, has a lot to tell us about the forms of revanchism that begin to emerge politically in this moment of capitalism. Because if you are unable to see yourself as really part of a society tied up in the what, you know, Martin Luther King called those bonds of mutuality, and you see everyone else as a competitor, then you have a very difficult time understanding the ways that a society might need to redistribute wealth, or it might need to address systemic and structural issues. And you can only see those attempts to redistribute wealth or address systemic and structural issues as impositions on your own competitiveness if you come from those groups that are privileged enough not to be the beneficiaries of that redistribution. So, for instance, we've seen in the last 40 years of financialization and neoliberalism this sort of visceral antagonism towards anyone perceived, and often the perception is incorrect, but anyone perceived to be gaining some sort of benefit from a redistributive state. And this vitriol is often, almost always, I would say, racially encoded, which presumes that some sort of racially normative white majority is being taken for a ride by opportunistic racialized people who are claiming sort of unfair advantages or benefits from the state. The narrative that Bannon was able to spin at Breitbart and in the Trump campaign was of making America great again, this idea that we need to, quote unquote, return to a moment where we could all be our competitive best and where there were no sort of advantages for any particular group, based on this completely skewed notion of how society actually works, and that draws on a reservoir of deep racist sentiment within the American culture and politics. So financialization, in a certain sense, is part and parcel of this political transformation in the imagination, which is very deeply tied to a culture of racialized fear and resentment that has been so acutely marshaled by these sort of revanchist political movements from the right.
That's Max Haven talking about his forthcoming book, Revenge Capitalism, due out this year from Pluto Press. Max is Canada Research Chair in Culture, Media, and Social Justice at Lakehead University in Ontario, Canada, and he directs the Reimagining Value Action Lab. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain. We turn now to an interview I did with Helena Sheehan about her recently published memoir, Navigating the Zeitgeist, a story of the Cold War, the New Left, Irish Republicanism, and International Communism. A radical philosopher and activist, Helena Sheehan participated in a great variety of social movements and political groupings, including the New Left, the IRA, and the Communist Party of Ireland. She visited the USSR more than once in the 1970s. Here's a portion of that interview. So I think it was the second time you were in the USSR. You first went, as you said, to attend the International Lenin School. Then you were invited back to continue and pursue your research. And you were studying, you were learning, you were engaging with Soviet society, and you were invited to speak and to be interviewed on Soviet media. What did you tend to speak about? And specifically, I'm wondering whether the work you were doing about debates within Marxism, within communism and communist ideas, whether you shared some of that, even though perhaps you felt that the Soviet authorities might not be enamored with that kind of expression.
Well, I met people in the Soviet Union who were the precursors of glasnost and perestroika, though the words weren't in circulation at this time. This was still the 1970s. But they were people that were leaning in that direction. And they brought me on to broadcast on Moscow radio because there was a version of Marxism, and it was strong during this Brezhnev period. It's sometimes called the era of stagnation. And it was just a very stale, rote, mechanical version of Marxism that some of them, you know, didn't believe at all. You know, people join a party of power and there's an orthodoxy in the whole system and you parrot it. And, you know, there were people that were, you know, sick of it. And I was never attracted to that. And I suited their purposes because, on the one hand, you know, I was a member of a communist party, and I was quite an orthodox Marxist. On the other hand, you know, I wasn't uncritical. I believed it in a fresh, honest way. And I could articulate it in a way that was fresh and honest and that articulated some of the problems. And they felt that, you know, that was really more in the interests of the Soviet Union than the, you know, the tired, canned kind of thing that even a lot of foreign communists parroted when they came to Moscow. And I suited their purposes. I could go a little bit further than they could because I was a foreigner. For example, I was giving a talk at the Institute of Philosophy of the USSR Academy of Sciences. And like I mentioned the names of Trotsky and Bukharin. It almost didn't matter what I said about them. But in those days, you never even mentioned their names. And there was this sort of frisson of, you know, affirmation. Because I could do things that other foreigners couldn't do because I was a communist. I could do things that other communists there couldn't do because I was a foreigner. So I began to see that I had that space and people sought me out to fill that space. And that was who I was. And so I happily filled that space.
What was Eurocommunism at the time? And why did you adopt what you call in this book a left Eurocommunist position?
Yes, it's not really the right name for it, but you have to kind of go with names, you know, as history evolves them. Eurocommunism was a movement beginning within Europe, but by no means confined to Europe, for communist parties to, you know, to think freshly what their own line was and not just take it from Moscow. So that's what Eurocommunism was. But I was a left Eurocommunist rather than a right Eurocommunist because I thought a lot of them were going too far. A lot of them actually became anti-Soviet in certain communist parties in Britain, in Spain, in Italy. They were just reacting so negatively to this Soviet-dominated, sometimes very mechanistic view of Marxism that they tended to reject too much. They rejected the whole idea of economic determinism, any kind of scientific determinism, the role of the working class, even class, they became hostile to class analysis. And I was critical of the Soviet Union, and that got me in trouble with my own party, but I didn't agree with the position of these other parties that were too negative about the Soviet Union. My attitude then and my attitude now still is that there is more to defend than to denounce about the Soviet Union and the other countries of Eastern Europe. But that didn't mean being uncritical and being and looking at the problems full in the face and being completely honest about the problems. And that got me into trouble in my own party and also in certain forces in the Soviet Union.
You were against orthodoxy. You were against the suppression of dissent. You were against a one-party state. So what were you for? Were you for a political situation, a political structure in which there were multi-party elections, for example?
I wasn't immediately in the 70s against a one-party state. By the 80s, I was. But at that point, I wasn't arguing against the one-party state. But yes, eventually, I was. I don't think that the one-party state was defensible. I think you have to allow multi-party elections. I think you have to allow other forces to organize. And I don't think there should be such a thing as an orthodoxy in the state, in the universities. I don't think that one party should have a monopoly of power. I think that, you know, people, you have to win people's hearts and minds and get them to vote for you in honest, open, democratic elections. I came to that view, though I defended the one-party state for a while.
Your research focused on, among other things, philosophical debates that took place in the Soviet Union in the 1920s. How relatively open was the terrain of ideas and the ability to debate those ideas in the 20s as compared with the USSR under Stalin?
Well, studying the 1920s in the Soviet Union was a real revelation to me. It was against everything I'd ever been taught about the Soviet Union. The 20s were absolutely fascinating. There were debates about everything, absolutely everything, from the five-year plan to marriage to free love, everything, everything was debated. And the interesting thing was that not they were debated in the society, but they were primarily debated within the Communist Party. I found that was really fascinating.
Mm.
And so I got particularly into debates about science and philosophy, but I put them within the context of these debates about everything. Then it was quite free until the late 20s.
You write near the end of your book that you found it hard to respect women who did not work, and that you argued that labor was essential to liberation. This was the early 1980s, I believe. How did you come to those conclusions, especially about women needing to work?
Yes, this is rather controversial even now. The whole wages for housework thing came up, and there's a lot of interesting social reproduction theory. I agree with social reproduction theory, but I don't think that wages for housework is the answer to that, because I think that it reinforces the traditional division of labor according to gender, and it also is part of the whole neoliberal agenda of commodifying everything. I just think that at the most basic level, I think that we live in a world where, you know, people have grown food, built houses, made clothes, created everything around us. And I don't think you can live a full and purposeful life unless you make a contribution to that, unless you give something to the world in exchange for all that you take from it. And I think that restricting female work to the family home is just not enough to live a meaningful life. I think that labor is essential to liberation, and that things will never be right for women unless the association of the female of the species with domestic labor and the male of the species with, you know, public labor is broken down.
The voice of Helena Sheehan, professor emerita at Dublin City University and author of a memoir entitled Navigating the Zeitgeist. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And today I'm presenting a set of highlights, portions of interviews I conducted in 2019 that I found especially thought-provoking. Next up is Manu Samnotra, assistant professor of political theory at the University of South Florida. He wrote an essay about Gandhi's thought that caught my eye, and when he joined me, he began by discussing Satyagraha. Satyagraha, Manu told me, was the civil disobedience conceptualized and practiced by Gandhi with the goal of insisting on the truth that we're all part of one human family. I asked Manu Samnotra what Satyagraha has to do with dialogue and with the bringing together of different perspectives.
Dialogue is an integral part of Satyagraha. So Gandhi once said that, quote, every case can be seen from no less than 7 points of view, all of which are probably correct by themselves, but not correct at the same time and in the same circumstances. So if truth is, as I mentioned earlier, multifaceted, and the Satyagrahi is insisting on the truth, then in order to capture that capital T truth, the Satyagrahi needs the corroboration of truth from other people. And so dialogue is fundamental to how a Satyagrahi is able to actually capture or understand the truth that the Satyagrahi claims to be insisting upon.
You write that for Gandhi, the first step in any Satyagraha struggle is to discover the conditions one seeks to address and to look at those conditions from a number of perspectives, not just the perspective of the oppressed. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so this is kind of important because at some level, you know, Gandhi wants to make sure that if you're insisting upon the truth, you actually understand it in all its facets. So in hindsight, and of course we know this now, many of the moments in which he initiated a Satyagraha movement, those instances, the truth or justice was on the side on behalf of whom Gandhi started this movement. But as an actor going into the situation, you do not know what the reality is. And so two things are important. One, you try to find out as much as you can about both sides of the situation. So, for example, one of the first Satyagraha movements that India, that Gandhi starts in India, is in a village of Champaran, where the farmers are being forced to plant indigo and have to pay high taxes, and they are suffering as a result of the policies of the British government. So when Gandhi goes there, he tries to find out from all sides what the reality is. And of course, he finds out very quickly that, in fact, the farmers are the ones who are in the right. But that, besides that point, the other important thing that's happening here when the Satyagrahi tries to find out what everybody thinks is that he's trying to show his goodwill. He's trying to show that, look, I'm not here as an ideologue who's come in and have already, in my mind, set the terrain of a political disagreement in advance. I'm here to actually learn. And so I'm willing to be as persuaded by you as by the people who have called me in to help them organize their protests. And so it sort of sets, as a first movement, the terms by which the future struggle will follow. And in this case, it's by showing a certain kind of goodwill.
Yeah, and this is very profound because a lot of people who engage in a political struggle would tend to see the opposing side as the enemy and therefore not deserving of goodwill, not deserving of a kind of positive interest and maybe compassion.
Right. And so as a result, I mean, so I rely on the work of other very great Gandhi scholars. I have in mind the work of Karuna Mantena, who basically says that Gandhi is in some ways a realist. That, you know, we tend to think of Gandhi as an idealist who is, you know, attached to political principles that cannot possibly be implemented in the world as we actually have inherited it. But these other interpreters of Gandhi argue, and I think correctly, that Gandhi is actually quite aware that the terms by which we start a political dialogue, the terms by which the entire thing is set into motion, has to be done correctly. You have a greater chance of succeeding in your political aims if you are receptive to the aims of those against whom you're opposed. And so again, going back all the way to the idea of truth as being, you know, that we're all part of one human family, Gandhi believes at a spiritual level that he will not lose anything by learning about what other people think. He will actually gain a greater insight into the shared reality. And perhaps in the process, by showing this goodwill, he might actually persuade them that they too can learn about the shared reality and come to understand the people they're opposed to as, in fact, their allies in the future.
This is a big question, I know, but what did Gandhi think about modern civilization, and what was the fundamental target of his critique? What aspect of modern civilization did he not approve of?
So for me personally, this has always been the part of Gandhi that takes my breath away. The audacity almost of his intellectual gymnastics, and I think really well done gymnastics at that, opens the space for political thinking in ways that I think most political thinkers that I've spent my time reading are unable to do. But in order to get at that, we have to first understand what civilization means for Gandhi. And so I'm going to quote from Gandhi here, quote, "Civilization is that mode of conduct which points out to man the path of duty. Performance of duty and observance of morality are convertible terms. To observe morality is to attain mastery over our mind and our passions. So doing, we know ourselves." So when I say that it's the sheer audacity of what Gandhi is doing here is, when I say that, it's because by defining civilization in this way, Gandhi is able to flip the script, something I had mentioned earlier, on the dominant ideological narratives surrounding colonialism. I think as most of your listeners would know, the colonial claim, at least in the case of the British Empire, the colonial claim was, we are civilized, you are children on the civilizational ladder, and through our tutelage, you too can be civilized. When the colonizer says that they are civilized and the Indians are not, what the colonizer believes is that the colonizer has modern industrial capitalism as the engine that will make civilization possible. Correspondingly, because the Indians lack in modern industrial capitalism, they are not civilized. And therefore, the task of civilization is to bring railroads and to bring modern medicine and modern education to Indians, to the benighted masses of India. When Gandhi defines or redefines civilization not as the things that will become available to us, the conveniences we will have, faster travel, better medical health care, more scientific education, when he says that's not what civilization is, but the performance of our duties and our moral sensibilities, when he says that's what civilization is, he is flipping the entire script. And what he's essentially saying is that modern civilization, as it's claimed by the British, operates on the principle of multiplying your desires. You want more things. You hanker after more things. If we redefine civilization not as the things that we want and the things that we claim a right to have, but the things that we must do, we draw a boundary around what is our due. And proceeding from that perspective, we are likelier to engage in other regarding behavior than we would if we were simply driven by the conveniences of modern civilization, as defined by the British.
What did Gandhi know about the working conditions of industrial workers in Britain? And what did that say to him about the level of civilization that Britain actually could lay claim to?
So Gandhi was somewhat familiar. I mean, he was in London as a law student, the University College London, I think. And so he had lived in London for some time, and he had seen, this was 19th century London, so it's, you know, pretty grim. And so he's seen some the working conditions of and factory life there, and he's read stuff about this. And his worry is that the motivations that have been guiding the British have lost touch with this definition of civilization that I mentioned earlier that he gave, which is premised on duties. Rather than thinking about their duties to each other, the British have made rational calculation the mechanism by which they evaluate their own progress. And so drawing on a number of British thinkers, most prominently Ruskin, whose book Unto This Last Gandhi translated as Sarvodaya, Progress for All, drawing on thinkers like Ruskin.
John Ruskin.
Gandhi was clear that what should motivate us are social affections, our desire to do good to each other. And because the British have lost sight of that, very far from being the most civilized nation on the earth, they are in fact the least civilized.
Manu Samnotra is his name. He teaches in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. We focused on an article about Gandhi's thought that he contributed to the volume Constructing the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Today's 2019 Highlights program continues with Michael Bourvoy, sociology professor at UC Berkeley, who recently wrote a book putting the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu in conversation with a number of thinkers, including Karl Marx. We begin with these remarks Michael Bourvoy shared with me about Marx.
This is all subject to debate, but my view, there are basically four elements in this particular engagement with Bourdieu. I reduce Marx to four elements. One, a theory of history, which was a succession of modes of production. Now, a mode of production is nothing other than the way we produce things. Marx viewed the way we produce things involved two sets of relations. One set of relations is our relationship to nature that we are transforming in some sort of labor process. And the other is the relationships of ownership. So it's not just who does what, but actually who gets what. Those are the sort of two dimensions of a mode of production. And then he said that, you know, you start with a sort of sometimes called primitive communism, tribal mode of production, and then you move to the Asiatic, then you move to the feudal, then you move to the capitalist, and then Bob's your uncle, you move into communism. It's a sort of an evolution that people sort of are very skeptical of, and rightly so, I agree. But anyway, that was his view of history as a succession of modes of production. He also had a theory of the internal dynamics of each mode of production. He didn't have a theory of any mode of production except for the capitalist one. And he argued in the case of capitalism that as capitalism developed, as capitalists competed with one another, they generated, on the one hand, crises of overproduction, and on the other hand, they deepened class struggle. And He argued that there is a coincidence of the deepening of the crises of overproduction, which we see all around us today, a coincidence of that with the intensification of class struggle that will lead to the working class seizing state power and introducing communism.
Overproduction being capitalists overproducing things.
Right. And they come about because what is happening under capitalism, they're competing with one another. And in the process of competing with one another, they drive down wages. And at the same time, they're producing more and more things. So there are fewer and fewer people to actually consume the greater amount that is being produced. And we see this. Capitalism goes through these cycles all along. But the point I really want to make is that Marx had a theory of the dynamics of the capitalist mode of production and why it would sow the seeds of his own destruction.
Okay, so you gave us two elements of Marx's materialism. First, history as a succession of modes of production like feudalism and capitalism. Second, each mode of production has an internal dynamics. What are the other two then?
The other two, well, Marx also said that, and this is very important for the discussion with Bourdieu, he had a notion of superstructures. It was not just the economy, but there were superstructures that involved the production of ideology, education, philosophy, cultural forms, and politics too. Superstructures that actually, for the most part, kept the mode of production going. So ideology, for example, in this country, the ideology that if you work hard enough, you make it, that is a sort of a process. That is an ideology that actually many people believe, even if they don't, they know it's not true, they will still believe it. And it has the effect of atomizing the working class, making it more difficult to organize as a class. But anyway, the point is, ideology is important, even though he's critical of it amongst these German idealists, he never then brings it back to understand how actually capitalism manages to maintain itself, reproduce itself. That's the third. And the fourth is that history is also the history of class struggle. And that he believes, as I said earlier, in the intensification of class struggle. And this is what's so sort of interesting, because there's a tension between, on the one hand, the project of the state, of ideology, of culture, of politics to maintain capitalism, to undermine the working class. And on the other hand, there's a tendency for the class struggle to intensify. And which of these two wins out will determine, of course, the fate of capitalism. And he was just optimistic, or too optimistic, that class struggle would actually dissolve the distortions that ideology brings, would actually counteract the intervention of the state to actually promote an increasingly militant and capacious working class. And we now know he was wrong.
Did Marx see class struggle leading to workers' revolution, leading to the overthrow of capitalism, as inevitable?
Yes, I suppose he did. But he gave us the intellectual ammunition to understand why he'd be wrong.
How so?
Because, for example, what I was talking about before, well, the state. Let's still talk about the state. He had, in my view, an undeveloped theory of the state. So what does the state do that he didn't anticipate? Well, the state basically has an interest in keeping capitalism going, and it has an interest in actually doing what Marx, in the end, really didn't think it could do, namely enforce concessions to the working class. So what do we get after Marx dies? We get sort of minimum wage legislation. We get some sort of control of the conditions of the workplace. We get the development of some sort of minimalist, in this country, welfare state, in other countries, much more developed welfare state, all of which are material concessions for the working class. So the working class recognizes that it actually can make gains within capitalism. It doesn't have to go beyond capitalism. So, yeah, so Marx didn't appreciate that there was a new form of capitalism after competitive capitalism that would be a state-organized, in principle, state-organized capitalism that would actually lead the working class to struggle within capitalism rather than beyond capitalism.
We skip ahead now to these comments from Michael Bourvoy about how Pierre Bourdieu thought about what's possible in terms of workers acting against or in relation to capitalism. You'll hear him use the word habitus, which he'll define in short order.
When he examines the dominated classes, the working classes and allied classes, he argues that they develop a habitus that is inimical to the development of class struggle. He argues that they cannot see the conditions of their own subjugation. Now, Marx assumes that ultimately the working class can see through it all and see that their real interests are beyond capitalism. And he was the optimist, as I said. So Bourdieu is very much the opposite, the pessimist, and basically argues that the words he uses that the working class misrecognizes the conditions of their subjugation, though understand that they are a dominated, exploited class. And so this is the fascination, to my mind, of Bourdieu's work. It threads throughout this idea of symbolic violence or symbolic domination. That is a form of domination that is not understood as such. And so he argues that the working class does not understand the essence of their subjugation, just as men and women don't understand masculine domination, just as the education process mystifies or misrecognizes the character of class. So much of his work is about that. So he argues that so deep is this habitus of misrecognition that actually there is no hope for an alternative future in the development of class struggle. It's not going to happen.
Now, habitus, one of the famous concepts that Bourdieu has forwarded, what is it? Like, how do we explain what it is such that it makes people not able to recognize the conditions of their oppression?
That's the most controversial of his concepts, is the concept of habitus. He has the idea that social structures are, in a sense, internalized, and as such, they are taken for granted or not recognized at all. And that non-recognition or taken for grantedness is embedded and embodied in the habitus. And the habitus is more than just a mental thing. It is also a bodily matter, that we, in the very way in which we carry ourselves bodily, sort of affirm the world rather than critique the world. So he has an idea that there is primary socialization, then there is secondary socialization. So there's a layering of people's habitus, which can be seen like a person's character. So there are layers in the character, and it's very difficult to dislodge it. And so if a individual is brought up in a particular class, that individual will have a particular class habitus, and it will be very difficult to change. And they will accept the conditions of their subjugation as a result of that. And he argues that basically, you know, where Marx would recognize that the working class may suffer from mystification, may not understand things correctly, through struggle, everything, all the mistakes that they make will be dissolved. For Bourdieu, struggle's not going to dissolve this working class habitus that accepts the world as it is, and that actually often doesn't recognize class.
As Michael Bourvoy went on to say in this interview, Pierre Bourdieu suggested that academics, and specifically sociologists, could educate workers to understand, to properly grasp the conditions of their subjugation. Michael Bourvoy was speaking with me about his new book, Symbolic Violence, Conversations with Bourdieu. I'm CS, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and today I'm presenting highlights from some of my favorite interviews of 2019. We turn now to Margaret Hunter. Margaret Hunter is professor of sociology at Mills College. She joined me to talk about an article she contributed to the volume Shapeshifters, Journeys Across Terrains of Race and Identity. We began the interview by briefly talking about Rachel Dolezal, who created a furor in 2015 when her white parents publicly stated that Dolezal, who was president of the Spokane, Washington branch of the NAACP and who identified as black, was in fact a white person. Here's the discussion, some of the discussion, that followed. You use the term shape-shifting to describe what Dolezal was doing or performing. What do you mean by shape-shifting?
The authors of the volume that this essay appears in have all been using this term to, I think, broaden the way we think about movement between racial categories. We're definitely not rejecting the existence of racial categories. They still structure institutional racism in the country. But people do move between them and among them in different ways that aren't always literal forms of passing in the way we traditionally think about it. So we use shape-shifting to think about how people inhabit different identities temporarily, how they perform different kinds of aspects of race. And in my essay, I was thinking more about ways that people take on or perform certain forms of Blackness, even though they may not be saying that they are Black in the way that Dolezal did.
You talked about the movement, I think, of the Black middle class after the civil rights movement was over, and I guess the growth of the Black middle class. Can you lay that out and what you conclude from those demographic trends about Black identities and Black lived experience?
Absolutely. So the Black middle class grows tremendously after the civil rights movement, essentially after the at least legal guarantee of equal access to different kinds of social institutions, even though that hasn't been completely realized. Big strides were made in the civil rights movement. And so afterwards, you see more and more African-Americans attending college, getting degrees, moving into the professions, moving into the suburbs, etc. So in the past, the Black middle class lived with the Black working class and Black low-income families in the same neighborhood because there was complete racial segregation that was legal. So we called those vertically integrated neighborhoods, meaning from the lowest income to the highest income, all living in the same neighborhood. There's some benefits to that in the sense that mixed-income neighborhoods are good. They're desirable, especially for low-income people because they keep more resources in the neighborhood. However, those neighborhoods were also under-resourced because they were segregated. So they were overcrowded. It was hard to get loans to make improvements on the houses, so they were often dilapidated. And of course, constraining geographically in terms of where people had the option to live. So as the housing laws began to protect the rights of African Americans to live where they wanted, and even though that still hasn't been fully realized, we're certainly moving in the right direction, that allowed African Americans to move. But of course, one has to have resources to move. So you see the Black middle class moving out of segregated Black neighborhoods into more middle class neighborhoods in other parts of the city, or what we would typically see as first ring suburbs. But that movement was the beginning of a separation of a kind of Black experience. So you have a generation or two now of Black people who are growing up separate from longstanding Black institutions like Black churches, Black schools, Black political organizations that were more likely to be located in more traditional segregated Black communities.
And this fracturing of African-American identities from traditionally segregated Black communities marks, as you write, a new era in Blackness and Black identification. So are you saying then that this separation between people who identify as Black and maybe a kind of a traditional live Black experience is important for your overall argument about shape-shifting and the tendency perhaps of non-Blacks to take on Black identities?
Yes, for me, this is central to part of the argument. There are many ways to be Black. There are many kinds of Black experiences. In terms of popular culture and our popular understandings, those are still rooted in a Black lived experience connected to a traditional Black community, Black churches, Black neighborhoods, Black social organizations. And we now have more and more people who are growing up who are African American, who are separate from those and also separate from new Black organizations. Unless you live in a city with a really big Black middle class, you're likely to be dispersed among other middle class families and not necessarily in a Black community geographically. So part of what I'm arguing is that this separation of being Black from this Black experience has allowed people to say things like, oh, that person just happens to be Black, as if the Blackness is an identity separate from a collective history. And I don't think that most African Americans see themselves that way, regardless of class, but it has allowed the public, and I think whites in particular, to feel more comfortable separating out the uniqueness, individualness, lightness of identity from a collective historical memory.
Yeah, and as you argue in this chapter, this draws on a kind of individualism. You call it abstract individualism, one of the frameworks you maintain of the new racial discourse. I take it this individualism is precisely about like someone's ability, an individual's ability to make choices even in the arena of race?
Yes. I mean, the idea of individualism has been true about how we think about race for a long time, in part because whites tend to see themselves as individuals and not a part of a racial group, unlike most people of color in the United States who see themselves as both individual but also part of a larger racial group or identity. And that dominance of the individual narrative, it pulls away the social context. It makes it easier to say, I am just like this other person who happens to be of a different race, and we are each making choices about our futures, and those choices are leading to our outcomes. It's a very unsociological way of thinking about race, but it's actually very common in the United States to see people think about themselves individually only in the context of their own life, not in a larger social context and definitely not in a historical context. So it's now very common to see white people take on affectations of Black English in their speech, to wear their hairstyles in more traditionally Black ways, to take on other aspects of Blackness because it's popular, because it's mainstream, and it in some ways has some status attached to it. I think that's interesting. What I think is problematic about it, and this is the piece where I'm trying to think about cultural appropriation in a more complicated way, is that sometimes it's that process of what other people have called everything but the burden, where Blackness is performed, sometimes mimicked, often for profit, but with no connection to an actual Black lived experience, only a performed Blackness.
Portions of an interview with Margaret Hunter, a sociologist based at Mills College, about an article she wrote for the new volume Shapeshifters, Journeys Across Terrains of Race and Identity. Maggie is the author of Race, Gender, and the Politics of Skin Tone. This is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and I hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.